Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Don't Neglect the Data, Data Modeling for Interoperable Systems. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speaker, Lacey Ray Trayball from RTI. Today's schedule consists of a 50-minute presentation, leaving about 10 minutes at the end of the hour for the audience Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some features of your audience console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box enables you to participate in today's event. You simply type your question into the box and submit it using the Submit button. You can submit a question at any time during the presentation. We encourage you to do so early and often while you're looking at the material and the question is fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these as possible during the closing Q&A. And if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you could submit those too, and our technicians will be happy to respond to you during the eCast. Finally, this eCast will be posted online within 24 hours, and an audio podcast will also be made available. We'll talk about this more at the end of the Q&A. Our presenter is Lacey Ray Trayball with RTI. Lacey began her engineering career at Brown and Caldwell, working on water and wastewater treatment system specification and design before transitioning to Northrop Grumman. At Northrop, she worked as a lead system engineer on multiple IR&D and CR&D focusing on data architecture, data modeling, and software integration to enable semantic interoperability among disparate systems. As a systems engineer at RTI, she actively participates in multiple standards organizations, including FACA, E, and UCS. Lacey, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm Lacey, and today I'm going to talk to you about data modeling for interoperable systems. So why do we care about data modeling for interoperable systems, and why do we want our focus to be on the data? Well, we live in a world that's in the midst of a financial crisis, and we have security issues and other vulnerabilities that we're really concerned about. Many of our customers have QRC needs that they need addressed, and on top of all of that, there's the dynamic nature of the geopolitical environment. And these situations have come together to produce some problems. The ones that you're all probably very familiar with can be seen in the software systems and integration arenas, where people can no longer afford to build all of these new systems that they need from scratch. They're becoming really keen on the idea of reuse and extending the capabilities that they already have from their systems that they already own. And in some cases, they simply just don't have the time to wait around for the standard program cycle, which can go upwards of 5 years, in order to produce and deliver a capability that was needed yesterday. And with all of these things happening, there's one thing that hasn't changed, and that is that everyone wants to stay in business and wants to do their job. The defense agencies, they still need to spec, procure, and deploy really useful systems. And other companies and organizations across many other industries still need to do the same. And in response to that need, there's many of us who still want to be able to design and build those relevant, useful systems for them. So how do we do this? What's going to enable us to achieve these goals, to maintain relevance and even growth through tough times? Well, we want to support the needs, so we're going to have to do something a bit differently. It's not enough to simply declare or mandate something like a data standard in order to facilitate system interoperation. We need something more. We need a way where we can derive more utility out of those already deployed assets, and we need a way where we can maybe achieve inherent interoperability as a key property in our systems. So today, I'm going to talk a lot about data. And the key element for meeting the need for interoperability in a system, I think, is data, because systems operate on data. And because of that fact, in order to integrate our systems properly and to have them truly interoperate, we need to focus on the data and pay attention to how it's used and how it behaves in our systems so that we can properly design and architect solutions to meet the needs. Data modeling to achieve interoperability just kind of makes sense. So we're going to start off by focusing on systems integration and interoperability, and then we're going to shift to that and discuss data modeling for interoperable systems, because the systems operate on data. And integration of systems and systems comes paired with a rather large element of complexity. So how do we work through that complexity? Because we can't remove it from the system. We can only hope to manage it. And at RTI, we advocate doing this by paying a lot of attention to data and by being what we call data-centric. So lastly, we're going to talk about a solution that involves RTI's products and services, where we can help you achieve this. So what is a system? A system is made up of components, and we sometimes call these components members or agents, applications or subsystems. And we characterize systems by many things. Systems have a structure or an organization to them. They display behaviors ranging from very simple ones to very complex ones, such as emergent behaviors and other patterns. Systems live in environments, and the environment that the system's in is defined by the boundaries around it. Systems have processes and transformations, and the architecture and the system design dictate a lot of this. So a system can be defined as a set of entities where it's comprising a whole thing, and all of those components are going to interact or work together, and they're going to produce some common result or serve an objective. One thing that we do with systems is we integrate them. So integration is just the process of linking together all of those different components or subsystems or parts. And we do this in a way where in the end, we want them to act as a coordinated and unified whole. Integrated systems can interoperate with each other without mediation. So they're designed to work that way out of the box, essentially. Where do we see integration in our everyday lives? Well, I like this example. So when I really need to charge my phone because I forget way too often, really, I grab my cable and I plug it in. And on one end of my cable, it connects to my phone, and on the other end to a power source. And after a bit of time, my phone's charged. This really simple example demonstrates an everyday integration of systems, where I have my phone and my power system. In this particular case, the two interfaces were designed in such a way that they work together. I didn't need an adapter or a mediating component. Next up, we have integratability. Integratability is a property of the system. It's the ability for some combination of systems to come together and to form, coordinate, or blend into a functioning unified whole. On the previous slide, integratability was the ability for the power system, my cable, and my phone to come together and become, well, essentially useful, because without power, my phone would just be a really expensive paperweight that comes with a monthly service contract. And next we have interoperation. So we talked about integration. Now, interoperation is the setup of components and methods to make two or more systems work together as a combined system. Interoperation requires some level of interoperability to have been achieved during integration. There are ways, such as components, mechanisms, methods, that we can achieve interoperation. Bridges and adapters are examples of these. And the components that we usually use to perform mediation between interfaces, they go between the systems that we're integrating. So with regard to data, a mediation component could be capable of doing things such as transformations or mappings. To successfully enable systems to interoperate, they're going to require a matching of specifications or interface standards through some means. So say this power cable for my cell phone is the same one, and I'm now in Spain visiting a friend, and I just arrived at my hotel, and my phone is dead. So I grab my phone and my cable, and I go to the wall to plug it in, and there's a complete interface mismatch. These components were not designed in a way that allows them to be integrated right away, but I really need to charge my phone. Since the systems were not designed to work together, the solution has to be architected if I want them to interoperate. I need mediation. So here, interoperability can be achieved through the mediation layer and adapter, which is going to allow for those two systems to be integrated without requiring a change be made to one or both of the interfaces. I don't need a new power cable to charge my phone. I just need the adapter while I'm in Europe. The integration example that we had before achieved interoperation without the need of that mediation component. In the cases where I require an element such as this to achieve interoperability, interoperation is achieved by architecting a specific solution that matches the interface standards. So there's one kind of system that we're going to spend some of our time talking about today, and that's a system of systems. And a system of systems is a collection of task-oriented or dedicated systems that pool their resources and capabilities together in order to create new, more complex systems that are going to offer more functionality and performance than the simple sum of the constituent systems. And interoperation is a very key concern here, as you can tell. It's different than a standalone system, a system of systems. And because of this, it has different properties and behaviors. Some of those include that the operational independence of the components has to be maintained after integration happens. And they're also capable of demonstrating something called emergent behavior. So a system of systems has characteristics that we can talk about later in the Q&A if you like that are very desirable. And among other things, what it offers us is an increased capability using components that we already have. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that in order to achieve a benefit such as this, we're probably going to have to do a little more work. And we're going to need to architect and design our integration solution a little differently than maybe what we're used to. But before we start crafting our designs, we need to understand some more about the requirements for these systems. So we talked about integration and integratability. Those were two. The key non-functional requirement that we need to meet for a system of systems is actually interoperability. So interoperability is the ability for systems, units, and forces to provide services to and accept services from other systems, units, and forces, and to use those services so exchanged to enable them to operate effectively together. And that definition was taken directly from the DoD dictionary. So interoperability is a larger concept that is used in order to support system components. And aspects of interoperability that are required for a system of systems are not necessarily going to be required for standalone systems. One reason there's an additional requirement that we place on the system of systems, which is this one, and that the requirement is for a high level of interoperability, specifically for semantic interoperability, is because that when we have all these disparate systems created by different people, a lot of things went into building and designing and speccing that system that you're not going to know about if you weren't part of that team. So if we can achieve semantic interoperability through forming a certain kind of data model, things such as the decisions that went into creating the system or why we chose certain things or what, you know, lat, long, and alt meant really, those types of information things will be carried with the system and with the data model. So this graphic right here comes from the levels of conceptual interoperability model. And I've seen this in many presentations on data modeling. I'm sure some of you are kind of familiar with it. And this model was born out of the modeling simulation world, where they came to the conclusion that interoperability wasn't a really simple black or white thing, and that there were, in fact, levels of it that a system could demonstrate. And that by describing these kinds of characteristics a system would have at each one of these levels, among other things, they're providing us with a really great reference point so we can discuss interoperability in more detail, and then for you later to maybe be able to specify or meet requirements for interoperability with a bit more accuracy and clarity. So starting at the bottom, we have level zero, which is where we have no interoperability. Examples of systems that we would put here would be things such as standalone systems or what we refer to really commonly as silos of excellence. They don't demonstrate any capability for interoperation. The next level that we had was level one, where we had technical interoperability. You move from level zero to level one by establishing a communications infrastructure and then unambiguously defining the common network protocols that you're going to use. By achieving technical interoperability, you're enabling systems to exchange bits and bytes via shared communication infrastructure using the unambiguously defined protocol. As a result of this, your systems can technically interoperate, meaning they can exchange the bits, but unfortunately, this only guarantees transmission of bits, and that includes absolutely no information regarding what those bits mean. So we're not going to know if they're representing video or text even. In this example here, we have two people talking. Their interfaces are technically matched. So because of this, what we're saying is they can both hear and speak. So two doctors having a conversation. The two individuals can both communicate via spoken language. They can hear what the other one's saying. So they can encode and transmit. But because of the mismatch in the language or the symbol set, which the top one was Russian, the bottom one is Japanese, they don't know what the other person's saying. They just know that they're receiving sounds. And that mismatch means that they can talk all they want and they can be heard, but beyond that, not much can be accomplished. And this is actually a really great example of achieving technical interoperation but not being able to go any further with it. So in this example, what they're actually saying is good morning to one another, but they have no idea. So technical interoperability actually meets a system requirement for replaceability, and it starts moving you towards needing one for interchangeability. Thankfully, other than the technical standards, we have standards that help us reach higher levels of interoperability. But technical interoperability is a requirement to achieve the next level, which is syntactic interoperability. So we move from level one to level two by specifying a common data format to be used. And as a result of integration at this level, our systems can syntactically operate, meaning that they can now exchange, in addition to the bits, the structure of data in an unambiguous manner. In this example here, the two doctors are again having a conversation. And the individuals, because they can communicate via spoken language, hear what the other one's saying, they also now can understand the words. So a phrase, the problem becomes, can be syntactically valid, but its semantics can be completely misinterpreted. So here, the doctor's asking what the temperature was, which is a syntactically valid statement, and the other doctor responds with 37.2, to which she receives the reply that we need to get warming blankets, because they didn't know that 37.2 meant Celsius rather than Fahrenheit. So because of the mismatch, they can talk, but things might not be properly interpreted, so the appropriate intended actions might not occur. In this example, they have the syntactic interoperation part down, but they lack their common understanding to take it to the next level, which is the third level where we have semantic interoperability. So we move from level 2 to 3 by specifying a common information model, and that common information model is going to contain the meaning of the information, and that is going to be agreed upon to be used by all of the interoperating systems. And as a result of having this, systems can semantically interoperate. So in this example, again, we have the doctors talking, and because they now share the common meaning, they can detect when something is off and request clarification. If they didn't share the semantic model, this couldn't have happened. So here a doctor walks up and says that an apple is orange and yellow, and the other one replies with, what does that have to do with her surgery? To which she receives the response, oh, I thought we were talking about food. She didn't end up needing surgery. So that's important information that she wouldn't have been able to detect if they wouldn't have had the match at that level. And semantic interoperability meets our requirements for a system that demonstrates interchangeability, replaceability, sensibility, integratability, and a pretty high level of interoperability. And we think that this is a level that's required for systems and simulation, especially when we have disparate systems and systems of systems. Next, we're going to talk about data modeling for interoperable systems. How do we achieve this? Achieving interoperability between systems that were never designed to work together or haven't been designed yet even. A lot of people in all of these domains have noted that system architecture and the organizations, such as things like network topologies, have played a very key role here, and that if we can minimize the number of interface standards that the subsystems have to comply with, that we had an obvious decrease in integration efforts in our system. What we wanted to get away from was that point-to-point or N-squared integration architecture. Their solution to those challenges was combining the requirement for all participating systems to adhere to common data definitions with a peer-to-peer system architecture for integration. And that was a really good start, but it wasn't sufficient because that solution only gave us the opportunity to meet the requirement for interoperability. Without having a defined and explicit data architecture, the inter-process communications are going to be dependent on point-to-point, statically defined single-use interfaces still. So the common data model, as usually implemented, is not easily extensible. So we can't form new data entities or change the structure of a representation by an application in a consistent, uniform way. And then we indicate that data architecture has been largely ignored. So systems of systems, they need this, though. A data architecture for them is going to help them meet the requirement for communication between all systems, regardless if that system is a new system, an old one, such as a program of record system whose interface can't be touched, or a system that hasn't come to be yet. We need new approaches and methodologies. So what are we missing here? Well, first, maybe it's part of our definition of a model. So what is a model? A model is anything I can use in any way to represent something else. We use models to observe the effect on manipulating the original without actually having to manipulate it. A really good model is going to capture all of the details that I need to manipulate the original, but nothing more. And on the left here, I have a picture of an actual 1967 Ford Mustang GT. And on the right, we have a model of that same car. Now, let's say that you have a child, and that kid's going through a phase where they're really into cars, and they want nothing more than for what their dad has, which is that 1967 Mustang. Now, I love my kids more than anything, and I want to give them everything just to see all the fun stuff they do with it. But I am absolutely not about to give the keys to a car to a toddler. I would give them the scaled fit-for-purpose version, such as that toy model on the right. It has very little in the way of extras, but it's completely sufficient and safe to entertain a toddler. So what is a data model? Well, a data model is a representation that describes the data about the things that exist in your domain or your system. And if you have a system, since systems operate on data, well, then chances are you have a data model of some sort. And if you're a system integrator, then you're dealing with data models during your integration activities. Data models come in all kinds of different representations, and they're capable of expressing all sorts of different things with varying degrees of explicitness. Some data models are going to capture information very unambiguously, where other domains can even understand what they're saying, but some won't. And no matter where your data model falls on that spectrum, there's always a way to make it better. So here on this chart, I have examples of three commonly seen data models. The first one's a dictionary. It's a list of terms for a particular domain of knowledge, and it contains that list of terms, and it's paired with the definitions and pronunciations for those terms. And using a representation such as this, we can express what a word means. Next, we have learning and taxonomy, and that's an example of a hierarchical data model. It shows us the conception, the naming, and the classification of organism groups. These types of models represent information in the hierarchical format, and the common ones are classifications and categorization schemas. Using one of these, I can say something such as, this is one of those, or that is a child of that parent. On the last example, we have the periodic table of elements. And from this, we can tell things such as that gold has a certain weight for a certain number of protons. What I can't tell, though, is if two elements are going to bond just by what I can see on this table. So per the requirement that we stated for the data model definition before, a really good data model is something that's going to be able to capture the semantics or meaning of the things it represents in an unambiguous way. And it's going to have all the information I need to work with it, but nothing more. Systems of systems require different things from data models in addition to many other little things that go into this. So it's an appealing thing, a system of systems. But among other things, what we consider it to be is an opportunity for reuse of technology and investment. And it's a possibility for an entirely new capability to be born just by adhering to the right approach. And that approach has to produce that one key result, which was semantic interoperability. In a system, it's really important to model our data just to meet the general requirements. But in a system of systems, if you do it properly, you get these real tangible benefits from it for years to come. Going about it the wrong way is going to cause you those normal integration pains, though. So a system of systems is made up of many constituent systems, as we can see here on this diagram. And each one of those constituent systems is going to bring with it its own set of requirements that now that overarching system of systems has to support. And because of this, the set of requirements that the system of systems has to meet is actually the set that contains every requirement from each one of those constituent systems, plus that additional requirement for semantic interoperability. And as my system of systems grows, the set of things that it needs to be capable of expressing is going to grow with it. And that information from one system may need to be used by one system again or by many other systems. This isn't a trivial one-to-one mapping of system interface definitions, though, because that approach doesn't produce a system of systems that meets my extensibility requirement among many others. Instead, all of the systems have to generate, or be able to generate, sorry, the appropriate representation so that they can meet their own system requirements. And in the system of systems, that portion is responsible for the creation of what we're going to call mathematical constructs, which are going to be used to describe the data model with a formal language. And it's from those constructs that every other system can derive their required representation. So those representations are going to be interoperable. To achieve semantic interoperability between those constituent systems, we need a new approach to dealing with our data. So the system of systems data model has to meet these three requirements. The first one, it has to meet the requirements of every one of the constituent systems. Second, it has to support the overarching requirement for semantic interoperability. And third, it has to allow for changes to be made to the model without requiring that the changes be made to existing systems and applications that are already using it. So we've decided that in order to do this, we should adopt a very formal approach. And the components of this approach that we're going to talk about here today include a formal language, rigorous documentation, and identification of a formal process to carry this out. First, we're going to talk about a formal language for data modeling. We talked before about levels of interoperability and pointed out that we needed to achieve semantic interoperability. And if I need to be able to describe the data about the things that I'm trying to model in a way where I can capture something as complicated as semantics, I'm going to need a language that's up to the task, and a formal language is up to that task. Formal languages can be defined as a set of words over an alphabet, and sometimes the sets of words are grouped into expressions where rules and constraints are applied for how to form the expression and the allowed transformations on it. An expression that's created according to the rules would then be deemed well-formed. We've seen an approach such as this work very well in the field of mathematics and computer science. We have highly structured programming languages such as C, which are so rigorous and formal that they've managed to have a lot of success in consistently being able to capture the logic of programming. And this can be shown by their ability to use compilers and tools to generate binary. But what we need for a system of systems is very similar in order to do our data model. If we use a rigorous and formal language for data modeling, we can achieve those same benefits that they had with C. One of the key benefits would be to build unambiguous expressions. Ambiguities in the meaning of an expression cause lots of errors in systems, and we can't have that if we expect a system of systems to be truly interoperable. So using a formal language for data modeling would be a necessary thing to fill that requirement. Here on this slide, we have an example where we're going to talk about ambiguity in language. So forming expressions can be done in many ways, but natural language, which is the one on the left, and other ad hoc representations are really prone to ambiguities. So first we have a word problem stated in natural language, and then we have that same word problem stated in the more formal language, mathematics. Now, for a moment, let's just pretend that we're in a classroom, and this problem is it's on one of our exams, so we're probably in elementary school still in that point. But we get this problem, and what do we do first? Well, we read the problem. So the problem says that a pair of shoes that Claire wants cost $1,500, and she waits until they go on sale because she can only afford to spend $450, including 8.25% tax. On Monday, the shoe store discounts everything by 50%, and each day that an item is not sold, it's discounted another 25%. So how soon can Claire buy her shoes? Where do we start here? When I was given problems like this, I would start by defining my variables. I'd read the problem really carefully to ensure I didn't miss something because, teachers like to throw curveballs. And in the end, this problem would have left me walking up to the teacher's desk and asking for clarification because the ambiguities are not only present, but the result of them is that we have multiple solutions. And if you take those ambiguities into account and try and solve anyhow, what is your teacher going to do? Well, I've never had one that gave full credit when I gave multiple solutions, so you're probably going to get it wrong. Now let's state that same problem in a formal language, such as the one on the right. Here, we still have ambiguities. We can't get rid of that. But what do we get from doing it this way? When we state it as a mathematical formalism, we're able to see very clearly right away that there are ambiguities and that there are going to be multiple solutions. And because multiple solutions are equivalent to multiple meanings and it's not okay, this one actually does offer us something. It more clearly communicates whatever it is it's trying to say. So the basic conclusion from this is that formalism is a continuum, but in a system of systems, we need formalism because if we don't have complete control over the structure and content of all the constituent systems, which is what happens in all of these, then we need some element where we can have knowledge of exactly what's being expressed because we know that it's being done in a rigorous and formal way. The second component of the formal approach was documentation methodologies. And these decisions that we do here include requirements and use cases that describe the functionality of the data model, as well as non-functional requirements that describe the behavior of the model over the life cycle of the system. And documenting only the messages is insufficient. We have to document everything else about the system. The documentation doesn't end at the system. It involves the system, the data model, the key decisions, and all that other information that we're going to need to provide the context. So documentation methodology that we use in order to construct our data model as well as the resulting model, because system of systems, well, there are many potentially competing forces that are separated in time, and by controlling the organization and the effectiveness of documentation, we're actually doing something that's going to directly relate to the degree of formalism and consistency that we can apply to different organizations at different times and over the life cycle of the system of systems. The last component was the formal process. And because a system of systems has many organizational stakeholders, because every system or every component was not built by the same person, they're each going to have independent control over their part of the system of systems. And the processes that we use here in order to create and document the resulting system-of-system data model. They have to be able to enforce a high level of rigor that's going to be required in both the model and in the documentation. So in the end, when we put all the pieces together, this is what we hope to achieve. So we want the ability to take the things on the left that we need to model, including the system itself, and we want to be able to document the required structures, behaviors, and context within the system of systems. And we want to do this using a formal approach. We need to have our formally described data model and the formally described system of systems data model be captured in a way where all the information that is needed to ensure that the data has proper context so it can be interpreted properly by any of the other systems wishing to interoperate with it. We can generate that. So here we show the data modeling process, which includes capturing elements of the structure, behavior, and context of each one of the constituent systems data, and then the output being a data model. That data model may not be suitable for every single system. Certain types of systems work better with certain types of representations. There is data at rest, there's data in motion. Applications use data a bit differently, and all of those things need to be accommodated. In addition, there are certain types of representations that are used to better represent certain types of data, such as doing classification and categorization using hierarchical models. So we need the language so that we know that our statements are well-formed, so that we can say what this thing is and what it is not. By using a formal language, we're going to give us also the ability to extend the data model when things change, because we know they will change, without requiring all of the system elements to recompile. So we want to get rid of that idea of N-squared immigration. And we need the ability to be very expressive, because all of these systems are coming in with different points of view, and over time, there are going to be new things that they want to express. If we dictate to them that they can only express a certain set of things, we're limiting the future extensibility of our system. But we need to do that extensibility in a really rigorous and formal and repeatable way. And in doing that, we give ourselves the ability to essentially encode anything, because then we can decode it using the same rules. If we describe our information using formal languages, then we're not integrating to a message set or to a data definition per se. We're integrating via mediation, which is going to involve transforms and mappings on the information, because we know how they were formed, so we can decode them. The documentation portion is where we're going to be capturing things, as you mentioned, such as decisions, our outlooks, the context of the systems, and the data that the systems operate on, that we can ensure that we're producing the desired outputs and outcomes. If we're going to integrate our systems with other systems, this information becomes really important in order to ensure that they're properly interoperating. Semantic interoperability just simply can't be achieved without the information that captures the context of each of the individual constituent systems. So next we have the data-centric integration solution. What this touches on is the idea that we have all these different systems. So here we have a legacy system, a new system, and a future system. So we don't know what's going to be coming in. We don't know what the data types are going to be or how it's going to behave, but we know that we're going to need them to interoperate. So technical interoperability we can achieve by the communications infrastructure and protocol. And those are really well-defined things, and I'm sure most of us have approaches for dealing with that type of integration already. Syntactic interoperability is achieved through defining that common data structure we talked about. Now, if all of your systems are in a position to use that same structure, you're fine. But what if you're bringing in an old system, a legacy system, that doesn't match the standard that you're specifying for syntactic interoperability? You're going to need a mediation component there to allow it to interoperate. And the same goes for the semantic interoperability, where you have your common data definition. If one or more of those systems doesn't already use that data definition, you're going to have to do something about that. So at RTI, we're really passionate about being data-centric. And because we're passionate about that, our approach is actually pretty uniquely positioned here. And we have a line of products that can help you with your system integration and interoperability challenges. And in addition to those products, we even have service offerings that can help you. So here on this chart, we have RTI's data-centric integration solution. First off, we have the infrastructure portion that helps us with the achieving technical interoperability, which we call ConnectCDS. ConnectCDS is the middleware that we use as the foundation for our data-centric integration solutions. So rather than point-to-point integration by messages or by application-specific interfaces, using Connect DDS, we like to say that we're integrating to the data bus. I find it really useful to compare DDS in this sense to a database where we have producers that are agnostic to how data is used. So they don't need to know things like how many customers are there and what type of processing they're doing. Likewise, the consumers are independent of how data is produced. And this results in a really loosely coupled system. The integration model then can become a little more simple. You're integrating to the bus. So Connect DDS is going to help you decouple your system integration. You're not going to need to know details about the APIs and the applications, where they're running, the network changes, et cetera. And you do this by instead defining your global data space. You can actually have multiple global data spaces and integrate them together. It allows you to define your data model or topic model. So doing this, you can define a model for all of your applications and systems, and then that data model lives on the bus and can be used by all of the systems and the components that want to interoperate with it. And this doesn't meet everyone's needs, though, because we talked about the idea that systems evolve and the unanticipated happens, and you might need new data types. Well, the original DDS standard, it provided a means to define a data model, but it didn't specifically address the evolution or extensibility of that data model over time. And if there's one thing we know, it's that our systems are going to undergo changes. And as the systems change, so does the data. Until recently, we didn't have a standard way to address that use case, but now we do within Connect DDS, and that's X-types. Before X-types, our data model required us to associate the topic with a topic label. And if there were differences in the data reader and the data writer labels, then they were noted as being incompatible. They couldn't talk or exchange information. So to address this, the X-type spec was developed, and X-type is an extension of the OMG DDS standard. It looks at the structure of the type, not just the label, to determine if there is some element of compatibility present. So using that, you can have some interoperability across types. X-types will check for that. Sometimes the types are going to be slightly different but compatible. And in those cases, you can do some transformations with your readers and writers, but the specifics of that are actually outlined in the X-type specification, which we would gladly send you if you'd like it. So X-types addresses the need for extensibility in data types for use cases other than just the one-time integration. Connect DDS is actually the first implementation of X-types. Without mediation engines to perform transformations, though, this might not be the help some of you require. What happens then when you need something that can do more than that? When you need the ability to change your data model in a way that X-types can't accommodate or address? Or do a change that requires an element of mediation? Well, for that, we have Connect Integrator. And Connect Integrator is a mediation component for our data-centric solution. Before, the change to the model meant we had to recompile applications sometimes. But what if we couldn't do that? Or if the time and the effort that went into that was simply too costly, well, you could use Connect Integrator. So rather than integration to the bus or the data model, you can use Connect Integrator to integrate existing and legacy applications to the bus via the adapter. Integrator can also be used as a mediation layer, for example, when applications have incompatible data models or for cross-security domains. It allows for an abstraction layer to be placed between your legacy systems and your integration point into the infrastructure. It provides integration via an adapter that is placed in route, so it's placed between the data bus and between the service or the application, and it takes what's published by the data writer and transforms it into what the data reader needs. The adapters that we have here can accommodate DDS, JMS, and SOPA implementations, and transformations can be done on things such as types, field names, and we can add and remove fields. It can also normalize types, but because system integration is a non-trivial problem. At RTI, we've realized this, and we're continually working to evolve this solution, especially that mediation component. So in the future, look out for something that has more powerful transformations and maybe a more robust solution, but it's going to be building off the current Connect Integrator product. And that's all I have for right now.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Lacey. That was a great presentation. We've got a lot of questions coming in, so we'll just go right to the Q&A. In addition, we have Dr. Bill Antipas with us. He's also responsible for helping customers architect and deliver complex systems of systems. So I encourage you to ask questions to him as well and take advantage of his expertise. He's also actively involved in OSD's UAS control segment. Working Group and Future Airborne Capabilities Environment, the FACE consortium we were talking about earlier. Lacey, there's a quick question. Can you tell us what DDS stands for those who might not know? Hello, Lacey, do we still have you on the line?
Sorry about that. I was taking a drink of water.
There you go.
So I actually had to put it down. What was the question?
They'd like to know what DDS stands for.
Okay, sorry about that. DDS is Data Distribution Service. It's an OMG standard.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. So there was a question earlier in the slide. You talked about integration and interoperation. There was a question about can you kind of delve into the subtle difference between those two terms as you mentioned them with respect to your presentation?
Yeah, of course. So integration is an activity or process where we're going to be linking together systems. And in integration, the solution, I called it, I think the term was designed in. So it was when we had the power cable and the outlet and they fit together. Mm-hmm. So you achieve interoperability without that mediation component, right? And then we had interoperation, which was achieving the interoperability with mediation component. So they're kind of funny. They sort of overlap. Interoperability and integration, they do go hand in hand. In order to achieve interoperability, you have to undergo integration.
Uh-huh.
And I think that kind of covers what I said.
Okay, great.
Yep.
Let's see. Here's a question about DDS in the context of development methodologies. Does DDS lend itself to agile development? On one hand, the documentation requirements might seem counter to what Agile does. On the other hand, you mentioned data modeling needing to be flexible with the changing requirements, which is certainly within Agile. Can you use Agile when developing with DDS?
Bill, do you want to take that one?
Bill, are you on mute? I guess we don't have Bill
on the line. Did we lose Bill?
Maybe we lost Bill. Let's see. We'll just kind of move along until we can get Bill back here. There was a question about, there's talk about fusion of data. How does RTI treat fusion of data from multiple disparate services?
Kurt, I'll take the Agile question, if that's okay.
Okay, let's back up. Thanks.
Hey, Bill, how's it going?
We have Bill back.
It's going good. I pushed the mute button on the phone, and it took me offline. Sorry.
Ah, nice.
Agile development, the paradigm, is rapid development cycles. It's not so much about skipping the documentation, nor is it about skipping the planning. It's about shortening the planning cycle to something that you can handle in your sprint duration,
right.
And then feeding that information back into the next sprint. Working your data model as part of that cycle is a natural element, and focusing and having the rigor and the methodology, the process, to include the data modeling in your agile development cycle, that this approach that Lacey's been talking about actually improves the effectiveness and the speed with which you can execute your agile sprints. So they go hand in hand. The challenge is establishing the process by which you can incrementally add to your data model at the beginning of your agile development cycle so that it becomes part and a complete part, a functioning part of your cycle. They do go hand in hand, and it is a very good approach to use to begin an agile development cycle sprint.
Got it. Okay. Great answer. There's a question about what do you mean by the conceptual level of interoperability? Lacey, do you remember mentioning that?
That was in reference to the levels of conceptual interoperability model that the modeling and simulation domain came up with.
Okay.
It's just that there's that interoperability wasn't black or white. There were different degrees of it, and that depending on the level of interoperability that you would need to achieve in your system or among your systems, that you might need to do certain things in order to do that. So that, you know, the levels of the conceptual portion, it was that it wasn't black or white. It's on a continuum. You pick a point there that meets the need for whatever you're trying to achieve. So it's conceptual in the sense that at any given point, the one below it might not meet your need, and the one above it might help you accomplish something.
I see. Okay. Bill, here's a good question. This is probably fairly common. There's probably not a really good answer, but maybe you can elaborate. So if this person cannot create a data model without understanding the context of the constituent systems, how do they go about defining the data for inherency, because they don't know the context of the constituent systems that they, you know, have to be defined? Do you model expected behavior of those constituent systems and then further refine those things as they become more identified and more concrete, or do you have any recommendations?
The key element here about this approach to modeling is it's a documentation method. It documents what you know about your system, what you understand about its behavior, and that includes new constituent parts coming in that you perhaps didn't see or are new and novel, or extensions to current capabilities of the systems. The fundamental process is based upon the premise that when we start, we don't know everything about the systems. We don't know the unknown unknowns.
Right.
We only know what we're doing today.
Right.
And part of the methodology is the ability to extend the model in a rigorous way, in a way that if you add something, say we add a new system to the model, and you are the first person to see it, when you add those capabilities and behaviors that are described by the documentation or the behavior or operation of the system to the model, you add it in a way that's prescribed by the structure and process of the model. It's a rigorous way of adding it. And if I were to do it, I would follow the same rules. I would follow the same process. I would use the same underlying mathematical rigor. And we would actually get to the same equivalent, maybe not identical, but the same equivalent description. And it's this inherent rigor that allows us to add incrementally to the data model over time in a manner that is consistent and rigorous and not ad hoc. So this feature of the modeling mechanism allows us to extend our universe with things that we have not yet seen or anticipated, but that now belong in our universe. So we don't have to model everything in advance. The data model for a system, and particularly a system of system, is a living, continuously growing thing. And it is this rigor that allows that. And it's also the rigor that is different from other data modeling processes, which sometimes are less extensible than one would like and do lead to the challenge of I have to have included everything at the beginning in order to be able to use it later on. So that's one of the key features that's different about this approach.
Okay. Very good. Bill, while we have you, so let's go back to the question about how does RTI or the data model treat the fusion of data from multiple disparate services? It's kind of an open-ended question, but maybe it means you've got certain subscribers, or maybe you're gathering up disparate data, and you have one subscriber to that published data. Can you talk about how you treat fusion of data from multiple disparate services?
Sure. The model's role in fusion is to be able to understand and document the roles of various attributes or fields in a data message or data structure. Mm-hmm. So if I'm getting data from two sources, say I have two sources providing track information. Say they were built 10 years apart. And so they're both track information and they contain certain common data elements. They don't exactly overlap in their structure. And maybe the representation in one message system of the location of the track is different than the other. The purpose of the data model in this instance is to rigorously document, to consistently document what the meanings of those data elements are and their context, such that I know that latitude, longitude, or position in one message is equivalent to a northing, easting, or other position, location, representation in the other message. And the model tells me what those two, how they're related, and allows us to extract from the model the conversions and the equivalence relationships between those two contextually similar messages and correlate them. And then within either the middleware or a mediator application, you can implement the translations and mediation that is documented in the model and allow those two messages to interoperate, to be used either together or to add information to each other. So it's the model that ties the different messages that describe similar things together. And it does it in a consistent and documented manner so that this information is continued forward.
I see. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Lacey, here's a question that attempts to kind of bind what you were saying with something like the ISO 7-layer model in networking. So is in the software world, is like the technical interoperability you were talking about, would that be analogous to a physical layer in the ISO speak like Ethernet, or does it encompass a communication standard like, you know, I'm communicating with you using XML tags or ASN.1 or something like that?
So it could be in some ways both. So technical interoperation could have been something like the power cable and the outlet. Those are technically interoperating. But it's also things such as protocols like RTPS and AMPQ, where AMPQ is not as flexible and controllable as RTPS, but they're equally understood. And so one person might use one and another person might choose another, but we can interoperate with them because they're well-defined technical standards.
I see. Okay. Is there some standard defining these levels of interoperability? There are DDS standards. Maybe you could take a minute to just overview what those encompass.
The standard that defines the levels of interoperability that I referred to, it's just a standard the actual name is the levels for conceptual interoperability. It's that standard. It's commonly referenced in papers on data modeling and semantic web or interoperation on a lot of different levels. I don't think that at that level there are any other standards that define or declare levels of interoperability. Bill, do you know of any that are relevant to the data modeling portion?
The standards for semantic interoperability for the data model world, there really are none. The levels of conceptual interoperability comes from modeling in sim world from the late 90s, early 2000s, and that's as close to a standard for understanding the role of semantic interoperability in systems of systems. The technical standards are extraordinarily well established and well understood. The syntactic standards are well developed and are in a stabilizing path. The next area of work is the standards for semantic interoperability. And right now, the state of the art, the state of the industry, is that people are beginning to explore the characteristics that standards for semantic interoperability would have. But OMG and Open Group have active data model standards working groups, but neither of them have yet published a preliminary standard. So that's the state of the art in semantic standards.
Bill, how do you treat the following activities? Publish, subscribe, task, respond, direct control of other services and systems?
Thanks, Kurt. I really like this question. PubSub is a communications pattern. Request response is a communications pattern. Command reply is a communications pattern. So are the queuing behaviors. Taken independently, they all look at first blush as if they are independent and not related to each other. But if you drill down a little bit, you'll find that PubSub can be described as give me everything you've got whenever you've got it.
Right.
Command response at the same level can be described as give me this thing now. Request response. Command reply can be described as do this thing and tell me what your state transitions are. If you look at those things, PubSub says, is an expression of interest. My expression of interest is I'm interested in this thing. Give it to me all the time. Request response is I'm interested in this one thing. Give it to me now. And when you phrase it, when you look at it that way, you can implement the request-response pattern using an underlying expression of interest and a response to that in exactly the same way that you do PubSub. It's just that the interest is different, the specific interest is different, and the specific time is different. So if you control those two things or specify those two things, you can treat request response, PubSub, and command reply and queuing behavior as variations on the same underlying communications structure. So if you do that, then you look for the super pattern. Which one of these communications methodologies is the largest subset? And it's PubSub. By changing my expression of interest from everything to a particular instance or a particular data element, I've gone from PubSub to request reply. And that's how they fit together. So they're not separate items. They are stops on a continuum of different behaviors of the same underlying communications pattern.
Interesting. Okay. Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question, and this is an excellent one. The data translation made by the mediation, is it dealing with the objects or just with the message format? And then does RTI have some kind of data model for protocols? So maybe you can talk about, Bill and or Lacey, does the DDS from RTI come with data models for certain things? Or
usually we construct the data models for each
the topic model.
Customer. The topic model is the end result of that. But we create the DDS types and topics for a particular customer based upon their universe of discourse. There are instances where there are data models for entire industries, in which case you start with that data model, as in the industrial automation has a standardized data model. And you can start with that standardized data model, put it into this format, and then extract the types and topics for DDS or other mechanisms directly from that. So we work in our consulting organization, works very extensively in that area.
Lacey, do you have anything to add?
No, you covered what I would have said.
Okay, very good. Unfortunately, we've reached the end of our time. Want to thank Lacey and Bill for sharing their insights on data modeling and interoperable systems. And Bill, thanks for all the Q&A support. We at Open Systems Media and RTI also want to thank all of you for attending today's eCast and contributing those excellent questions remotely. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast version will also be made available. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media eCasts available for download as MP3s. Thank you for attending, and have a great day.